And our colloquial speaker today is our own Joe Pervante. Joe has completed his PhD at the University of Hawaii, and he did it in record time for sacrificing the surfing. So he didn't do any surfing, but only physics. And then after that, he spent one postdoctoral term where surfing is not an option in Notre Dame, and we are so super happy to have him here amongst our group. And Joe has worked on a wide array of things, starting from in collider physics, direct detection of dark matter, and very interestingly on the interplay between stellar processes in our galaxy and the dark matter physics. We're very happy to have this talk. Please.
All right. Thank you, Maxime. Thank you, everyone, for coming. If you want to rush out at 1:15, I won't take offense. Just come back afterwards. It'll be fine. all right. So today I'm going to be talking about dark matter with imploding pulsars, white dwarf explosions, and warm neutron stars. First, I've had the good fortune of having wonderful collaborators here. I'm just highlighting the junior ones because they need the most highlighting. So this is Tim Linden. He's a postdoc at OSU. Fatima Alahi, she's a grad student at Notre Dame who's moving on to a postdoc. Nirmal Raj, he's a postdoc at Notre Dame. Masha Baryakhtar, she's a postdoc here at Perimeter. Shirley Wei-Shi Lee, she's at Ohio State University. She's a grad student, but moving on to a postdoc. Yudai Tsai, he's a grad student here at Perimeter. And Jason Kumar, my advisor from back in Hawaii, who cautioned me not to surf, so yes. All right, so I'll be talking on broadly two topics, imploding pulsars, and all these authors have done really great work on this, so I just thought I'd put their names up. Also, white dwarf explosions has gotten some attention in the recent years from dark matter in both these cases. So yes, as Maxim says, my work spans direct detection, collider phenomenology, and connecting inflation in low energy particle physics, but today I'm going to talk about three things. One is that you could say that there's some emerging evidence that dark matter could ignite type 1a supernovae and implode pulsars. The second is some new astrophysical signatures of such an atomically productive dark sector. And third is I'll be talking about a new way to detect dark matter using dark kinetic heating of pulsars and next generation telescopes. And this is very exciting to me. So if you get lost at any point in this colloquium, the unifying principle is that we're searching for dark sector connections to the visible sector. So that is the theme throughout. And if you're not clear why that's happening, just ask me and I'll tell you. And seriously, feel free to ask. OK. So really quickly, you guys have seen two colloquia already, so I will skim this very fast. So for over 40 years, dark matter is seen in gravitational interactions. These are my little doodles that you've seen in other forms. I won't even talk about them. But today I'm going to talk about maybe how there could be emerging evidence for dark matter interactions with neutron stars and white dwarfs. And so the five things I'll cover is missing pulsars in the center of the Milky Way, fast radio bursts, the abundance of R process elements and how they're distributed through galaxies, and the ignition of type 1a supernovae. The fifth one really isn't a signature yet, but it's something to look for. And these are two new classes of astrophysical objects. Quiet kilonovae and R process donuts, and I'll explain what those are when I get there. Okay. So at the beginning of each one of these sections, just so you don't get lost, I will summarize the whole thing so you can just fall asleep after that if you like. Actually don't, but for dark matter imploding pulsars, the major points are that asymmetric dark matter can implode pulsars by forming black holes at their centers. And the second major point is that dark matter, which is more abundant in the center of our galaxy, would collect in and implode pulsars faster than out by Earth. All right, so to start off, I'm going to give you my favorite derivation in probably all of particle astrophysics, and that is the derivation of how neutron stars are stabilized by quantum pressure, or any ball, really, of matter in space. So if I just start with the Birol theorem, and I set the expectation value of the potential energy of a sphere of fermions equal to the expectation value of the kinetic energy. Then to calculate the kinetic energy, I just need to find what the momentum of my fermions is. To find the momentum of my fermions, I just apply the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that tells me that the momentum of my fermions is roughly 1 over their spatial separation or their linear density. Now, because they're fermions, they'll experience polydegeneracy. And that tells me that the density of degenerate fermions is roughly n over r cubed. So that tells me the linear density is n to the 1/3 over r. And now I immediately have the momentum of degenerate fermions in this stabilized ball of gas. Okay. That's the next slide. Yes. So now I can actually just plug that in, and I get the gravitational potential energy equal to n fermions with momentum n to the 1/3 over r, and this is divided by 2mn to make it the kinetic energy. So that's just p squared over 2m. Okay, so immediately I find some deep physical properties, and that is that the radius of this stabilized degenerate ball of fermions goes like 1 over n to the 3rd. Or in other words, if I have a stabilized ball of fermions that are supported by degeneracy pressure, and I drop in one more fermion, I should actually expect it to get smaller. And that's because it's becoming more compact, then I have more degeneracy pressure, because the momentum from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle will be greater. So this just tells me that more massive degenerate stars are smaller and denser. And I could ask, how heavy could it possibly be? Well, the most sort of degenerate kinetic energy I can possibly get out of it is if it's completely relativistic. And in that case, its kinetic energy is just n times its momentum, which is just n times n1 to the 1/3 over r. And then I can solve that. And I find that the mass of the neutron star is less than or around mass Planck cubed over the mass of the neutron squared, which is a solar mass, which is a little bit of a funny coincidence because the sun is not supported by degeneracy pressure. Okay, so any questions so far? Everyone happy? Okay, great. So next, I just need to very briefly tell you what pulsars are. Looking around, I know most of you in this crowd doesn't need to be told, but I will anyway. So pulsars are rotating neutron stars with a large magnetic dipole. They also have a small magnetic quadrupole, but that's another story. So their magnetic field can be up to 10 to the 14 Gauss, but it can get down to 10 to the 8 Gauss, and we can still find them. And they give you pulse radio emission along the magnetic dipole axis as they rotate. And so we can look at what that is visually. This is what it looks like. OK, great. So we can find pulsars by looking for their radio emission. If I want to know how old a pulsar is, I can actually use the time between these pulses to completely determine that. Up to some very big systematic errors, which I will perhaps talk about a little bit. So I have my pulse period P, and I have my pulse slowdown P dot. So every pulse period, the pulsar slows down a tiny bit P dot. So that's this little bit here. And the point is that if I think about the pulsar spinning for long enough, then all those little spin downs will eventually constitute the entire pulse period of my pulsar. So if I take the entire pulse period of my pulsar and I just divide that by the little pulse slowdown, I should get how old the pulsar is. And that's simply the characteristic age of the pulsar. Okay. All right, next I'm going to talk about the fact that there are missing pulsars at the galactic center. So we expected tons of pulsars at the galactic center because baryons are most dense there, and that's where we should find them. In fact, we expected up to something like 1,000 to be already found. Depending on whose estimates you look at from the early 2000s. They might have been a little bit optimistic. That's OK. But so far, we've only found a few very young magnetars. Actually, we found one of the magnetars just a few months ago. And so for a long time, people said, OK, well, it's really not a big deal. They're probably there anyway. The problem is that we have this giant electron screen between us and the galactic center. And so those pulses that we're expecting to see from these pulsars are just being broadened out. So we can't actually resolve them at radio telescopes. So here we have the galactic interior. It's about 10 parsecs wide. Then we have 8 kiloparsecs to Earth. And our pulses are just being broadened as they move through the screen of electron and scatter off the electrons. Okay. And these pulsars pulse too. Ooh. Okay, great. All right, so the next slide has a long history. So I've been giving this this part of the talk for a very long time. And anytime I would show the actual data in the next slide, everyone would be extremely confused. And so I tried to block it all out and slowly reveal it and explain the plot. And that didn't work. And so now I'm just going to leave the data and hidden behind this white screen the entire time. And the only way I can get to it is after the talk. I can move the white screen away from the actual data. And I'll do that for any of you who want me to. But I'm not going to show you the data. I'm just going to explain what it says. So what it says is that Well, it doesn't say this first point, but whatever. So it says temporal pulse broadening scales with the fourth power of observation frequency. So that just tells me if I look at a certain frequency, I expect this broadening or the amount I'm smearing my pulse out to scale with the fourth power of the frequency. But these magnetars at the galactic center, we can measure at a number of different frequencies. And using all those different measurements at different frequencies, we can say exactly what the pulse broadening is from the galactic center. And so based on those measurements, we should have already seen up to 50 millisecond pulsars and 50 standard period or second period pulsars. And we still don't see them. So this is the missing pulsar problem. OK.
What's the estimate of how many there should be based on?
I can tell you a lot of different estimates. We'll just do one really quick. So there are 300 OB stars at the galactic center that have been found. If that is a steady state quantity, in other words, if we always have 300 OB stars, then there should be at least 500 second pulsing pulsars in the galactic center, 500 young pulsars. And of those, we should have seen about 100 already, or maybe 50. Actually, yeah, because we could see 100 and about 50 would be above the threshold of radio emission if they follow the radio pulsing of all the young pulsars we see. So that's one way to do it. I could talk to you about many other ways to estimate, and but that's
when
good.
When you put it all together, what kind of uncertainty is it? Is it kind of a
blank? I don't even know how to answer that question. I can show you the number of papers that were written on different Gaussians to fit this. Some people say, I mean, some people just, yeah. There's a lot of different ways to cut the statistics. We've never studied the center of a galaxy and found what the pulsar population is. So it's a quite difficult question to answer.
Can I ask a related question? I mean, what about away from the galactic center? Is there an association?
Yeah, so you can look at globular clusters. These are very...
stars and,
Yes, yeah, you can use XRBs as tracers and say how many millisecond pulsars you expect based on the XRB population and globular clusters versus the XRB. These are X-ray binaries at the center of the galaxy. I've done this. there are many different ways to do this. For now, I'm not going to claim a significance to this. I'm just going to say there's perhaps a missing pulsar problem. Yeah, OK.
But the Fermi haze also does provide evidence for a large population.
So now we're on to the point sources. Yeah, so I mean, everything I'm going to say wouldn't be inconsistent with having quite young pulsars at the galactic center. It would just be inconsistent with having older pulsars. So I'd be fine with having a bunch of young pulsars. Or I'd be fine with us actually pointing gamma ray telescopes at those, resolving their pulses, and ruling this out. That's fine. OK. So let's see. So dark matter is captured, and the dark matter capture rate scales as the density of the dark matter, the cross-section of the dark matter off nucleons, and divided by the velocity of the dark matter in the halo. That last point is maybe difficult to understand if you haven't done these sorts of calculations, but the basic point is that slower velocity dark matter is more pulled in by the neutron star's gravitational potential. And the cross-section is mostly important for determining whether the dark matter gets captured after it gets pulled through the neutron star. So keep this number in mind. You can collect up to 10 to the minus 14 solar masses of dark matter in 10 billion years. So that number will become important in a little bit. OK, so dark matter thermalizes. So this just means it rescatters in the neutron star interior until it reaches the temperature of the neutron star. And then it forms a small thermalized ball at its center, sort of orbiting around at the center. It's about a meter-sized ball for GeV mass dark matter. And it gets smaller the heavier the dark matter is. Enough of it can collect that it can collapse to a black hole. And the two conditions for that are that the dark matter density at the center of the star has to be greater than the neutron star density. And this is so that it's unstable under perturbations. You can also do a genes analysis, which I've done. But anyways, it also has to exceed its own degeneracy pressure. But then you can immediately tell, if I just wanted to make the dark matter collapsible at the center of the star, how massive it would have to be by using the prescription for the maximum critical mass of fermions and the maximum mass I told you could collect, which is 10 to the minus 14 solar masses. So if I didn't want to do anything special, I could immediately get the job done with something like 10 PV mass dark matter, because that would be 10 to the minus 7 squared, 10 to the minus 14 solar masses. OK.
Is it obvious that it would just implode?
No, I mean, yeah.
Could the baryons find another resource to support themselves by forming a different phase or something like that?
Maybe, but as it's collapsing, it's going to start shedding kinetic energy. And I mean, that kinetic energy, those are going to be moving faster with more energy than the neutron star fluid has in thermal energy. So I don't know how you could support that indefinitely. OK. But maybe. So then you calculate whether the accretion of the neutron star fluid onto the black hole that you form is faster than the Hawking radiation rate. And if it is, then you assume that you form a solar mass black hole. I'll get into this accretion process a little bit more in depth a little bit later on. Okay, so we need asymmetric dark matter to implode pulsars. And the reason we need asymmetric dark matter to implode pulsars is that if it's not asymmetric, then because it's packed into a little compact ball at the center of the star, it's essentially just going to annihilate away to whatever particles it can annihilate to. So the real requirement here is that it be non-annihilating dark matter, but the dark matter candidate we have that's non-annihilating is asymmetric, and it's fairly well motivated because you can have the dark asymmetry linked to a baryon or lepton asymmetry. Another way to put this is the matter that we see in the halo is asymmetric, which perhaps could be an indication that the dark matter is asymmetric as well. Okay, so let's talk about dark matter models that implode pulsars. So first you could ask, does the simplest sort of dark matter model I can possibly think of work? And it doesn't quite. So if I just have GV mass asymmetric dark fermions, then you already know that because I'm only collecting 10 to the 19, minus 14 solar masses, and maybe a little bit more at the galactic center, but not too much more, that's not going to collapse under its own weight within the lifetime of the universe, because the neutron star isn't collapsing, and so we're done. However, if dark matter is bosonic, then it's not stabilized by Fermi degeneracy pressure, and instead it has a different sort of formula that tells you how it's stabilized, and I kept this formula free, but the crowd here is advanced enough that I'll just say the critical mass for the bosons, if they don't have any appreciable self-interactions, is just this, so it's one power of mass Planck down and one factor of mass down from the fermionic limit. The next thing you can do is you can have MeV to PeV mass asymmetric fermions, and then you actually just give them a scalar self-interaction. And this is a Higgs-Portal dark matter model that actually is very popular for dark matter models that solve the core-cusp paradigm. So actually the parameter space here overlaps with this self-interacting dark matter core-cusp dwarf galaxy story. So if you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. So you can actually set some of the best constraints on those using the fact that certain parts of the parameter space would collapse neutron stars near Earth. And the last possibility is that you can have extremely heavy dark matter, as I mentioned before. And the reason that works is because it's a lot heavier, so the critical mass is a lot smaller. You can actually do this with bosonic dark matter. The scaling there is just square root lambda, where lambda is its self-coupling constant, just like a quartic term. OK, so we already did the 10 to the minus 14 solar masses. So the very basic way to explain this is that dark matter in the Milky Way gets much more dense at its center. In fact, it follows a 1 over r profile. So its density increases as 1 over r at the center. So the capture rate, which scales with the density of dark matter over its velocity with respect to the neutron stars, which actually doesn't change too much, so we'll ignore it for now, tells you that dark matter at the center of galaxies should collapse pulsars a lot faster than it does outside of the galaxy by us. OK? And this gives you a prediction that Tim and I explored in 2014, which is that you should have a maximum pulsar age as a function of distance from the galactic center that tracks the dark matter density. And the little wiggle on top of the smooth 1 over r profile is the velocity.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
For the heavy fermion case, the upper bound of an EEV comes from the fact that it gets too sparse? Is that
the idea? You form a too small of a black hole and it evaporates. But you can play around with that parameter space and get it to work again. But yeah, just naively, I'm leaving it there. Yeah. OK. Cool, maximum pulsar age curves as a function of distance from the galactic center. And we can plot all the pulsars we found so far. There's some new ones, actually, from the last time I gave this talk. These are new. There are some new ones up there, too. So that's nice. We found another magnetar, but it's down here, so it doesn't show up. OK, so that's it for imploding pulsars. Any more questions? No?
Is it throughout, not on the logarithmic scale, but on the
I could replot it for you later, but no, I don't have that right now.
It's hard to see how this distributed.
Well, yeah, I mean, we haven't really imaged this area perhaps as finely as we want to, but yeah, it does help with the volumetric scaling, maybe see it linearly. But I can show you that later if you want.
Joe?
Yes?
That means that basically this one prediction is that you turn neutron stars into black holes.
Yeah.
does it change anything for the, I guess, merger rates or?
Oh yeah, we're gonna get there. Yeah, I'm gonna address that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so next I'm going to talk about our process elements from pulsar implosion. So we talked about these things imploding, and the basic points here are that imploding neutron stars can eject neutron star fluid that forms heavy R process elements. And dark matter-induced neutron star implosions could explain why R process elements are in just one of 10 dwarf galaxies. They could also be one of the major sources of R process elements in the galaxy. And there's some jokes about that, and I'll remind me if I don't tell you the jokes. Okay, great. So our process elements, because we don't know, are heavy elements with atomic masses around 80, 130, and 195. So they can be contrasted with, so R means rapid. And basically the idea is you need a rapid capture of neutrons onto a nucleus, or at least that was the original thought. Nowadays, it's more the thought that you fling a bunch of neutron star fluid into space and it decompresses. So that's how you get all your neutrons in one area. But it used to be that it was from core collapse supernovae, so you just needed to push all these neutrons into the nuclei. So that's why it's called rapid capture of neutrons. That can be contrasted with the S process, or the slow accumulation of protons or alpha particles onto heavy nuclei and stars, and that gives you these peaks, and this is all fairly well understood since the 50s and 60s. So Newton spent the latter half of his life trying to figure out how to make gold. He might have been happier in the latter half of his life. He'd known he just needed to take some neutron star fluid and throw it into space, and that's basically it. Because one of the R process elements is gold. I didn't say that yet, but yeah. All right, so possible R process sites, as I've already mentioned, are core collapse supernovae. And this would be frequent in a galaxy. It would happen roughly once every 100 years, because that's how quickly they happen. The other possibility are neutron star mergers. So the neutron stars merge, and they blow off a ton of this neutron star fluid out to infinity. So that would be a bit rare. You'd get one like every 10 to the 4 years. So a new possible R process site is a neutron star slurped into a black hole made of dark matter at its core. So you get tidal disruption, you get sort of the same messy system you get in mergers, and you could get R process ejection. So in each case, you have the neutron-rich fluid that beta decays and forms your heavy neutron-rich elements. So this beta decay will be important later because it'll be a source of light, which will be a signal. So just keep that in mind. This is where the light is coming from, the neutron star implosion. And gold, uranium, europium, and barium are all examples of R process elements.
Joe, I have a quick question.
Yes.
How far beyond the cartoon picture is the slurp? Like, do we really?
I have no idea. I'm literally trying to do numerical GR on it. Like, so I don't know. Yeah. So I'll take the mass ejected as a free parameter. To be fair, and I'll probably mention this again later, neutron star merger, neutron fluid ejection is only known to within like 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. So
I was going to follow with that.
So yeah. So I mean, curious. Yeah. So there's this R process in ultra-faint dwarf galaxy story, which is really interesting. So this grad student, Alexander G, was told, hey, go look for R process elements in ultra-faint dwarfs. Go do something. Probably nothing will happen because ultra-faint dwarfs don't have R process elements. So ultra-faint dwarfs are star-poor dwarf galaxies formed in a billion-year burst about 10 billion years ago.
What does star poor mean?
What's that?
So what does star poor dwarf
mean? Ultra faint dwarfs.
I never mind. Sorry, I read.
Oh, okay. Great. So he found just one high R process abundance galaxy and low R process abundances that were expected in all the other ultra faint dwarfs. But one UFD with R process elements and 9 without points towards a rare event, because all of these dwarfs would have had plenty of core collapse supernovae. But it would be possible for just one of them to have a neutron star merger and get a lot of R process elements out of it. And so just to show you the data, so these are astrophysical units. So this is the logarithmic relative abundance of barium to iron, europium to iron, iron to hydrogen. So the iron to hydrogen abundance tells you how old roughly the star is. So older stars are on the left, younger stars are on the right. And that's basically all you need to know. And the point is that reticulum 2 has a very high R process abundance, and these other dwarfs have a low R process abundance. And this statement seems to be fairly an age-independent statement. So the natural thing was, OK, obviously we get R process elements from neutron star mergers. But Tim and I we're interested in neutron stars imploding and creating our process elements anyway before this discovery. And so we did some critical inspection of whether neutron stars could actually give you our process elements through mergers. And it seems like maybe there's a little bit of tension between how our neutron star mergers actually happen and this idea that they create our process elements in dwarf galaxies. So the basic point is that every time you birth a neutron star from a core collapse supernova, it gets a kick of about 100 kilometers per second. So this would kick typical neutron star binaries up to 50 kilometers per second, but the escape velocity of ultrafaint dwarfs is 10 kilometers per second. And the time scale is such that you would kick it out before it merges. So the probability of one merger for all 10 UFDs after 100 or 500 million years, which is how quickly they have to merge in order to reproduce what we saw, maybe a giga-year, is very low. However, the rate for our process production from a neutron star implosion actually would be about right for some parameter space that would give you missing pulsars from the galactic center, which is here shown in green. So the basic point is that neutron star mergers would typically give you too few. Implosions seems to be about right. Core collapse supernova would give you too many.
But
yes.
What is the error in the estimates of how much our process?
Well, because me and other people have just an order of magnitude estimates that even when you do the full numerical GR, you don't get a really robust answer out. I don't even know how to begin estimating that. I can show you that the energetics are make it possible to eject up to like half the neutron star's mass, but I mean that doesn't really tell you whether or not it gets ejected in this sort of very turbulent tidal system where you're slurping all this neutron star fluid onto a black hole.
So I guess maybe. So what is the smoking gun of this? So how would you tell apart?
Oh, I'll tell you. Yes, again, yes. Yeah.
So come.
Yeah. So the next thing is you can get fast radio bursts from pulsar implosions. So we tossed around this idea, but didn't write anything up. And some other people wrote something up, so that's great. I'll tell you who they are in a second. So a bunch of unexplained millisecond-long radio pulses could be pulsar implosions. And the rate of fast radio bursts roughly matches this missing pulsar problem at the galactic center. So fast radio bursts, for an audience that all knows, but that's fine, are unexplained millisecond-long radio pulses. So they have a very high rate and power output. And there are many possible applications of these, including cosmological applications. So everyone's very excited about them. We've only found about 18 so far, and a few of them were microwaves. None of those were microwaves. Anyways, the rate of these is roughly 10 to the minus 4 per megaparsec cube per year, which is very, very high. And it turns out that if you do the basic calculations for how much power you'd expect emitted at gigahertz frequencies when you have a neutron star implosion, it roughly matches what you'd want to create a fast radio burst. And that's corroborated by simulations of accretion-induced collapse of neutron stars.
Did I just talk about an FRV that was repeating?
Yeah, so that would not be consistent with this, clearly. There are many studies on this. It seems like there's statistical evidence against these other things being repeating systems. But yes, it's very up in the air right now. And if it is just a repeating system, yeah.
This is not theory.
If it is just something that repeats a lot, then obviously, okay, fine. But otherwise, this maybe is a good way to.
But also, this is some degree of polarization in some of them, some turbulent polarization.
I don't know what you mean by that. Sorry. We can talk, though. Okay. So this is a recent thing that Yuda Isai and I have finished up, which is that neutron star implosion rates roughly match fast radio bursts. So what we did was a very careful calculation where we actually tried to incorporate neutron star dynamics, birth rates in the Milky Way, and actual population distribution. And sort of this green region that solves the missing pulsar problem lines up with the rate you would need to create all your FRBs, which are between these two black dotted lines. OK, so what's a really nice smoking gun signature of this, which Mina has already figured out? So you guys still didn't ask me the R process joke, so I have to tell you them at the end, but that's fine. So
why don't you say one now?
Oh, OK. So an R process joke is that if neutron star implosions are giving you your R process abundance, then dark matter is giving you the tools to find it, because two other R process elements are xenon and germanium. So. There you go. There's
That's
another joke.
Very physics, isn't it?
Okay.
Keep your day job.
So moving on. We have black mergers, quiet Kalanova, and our process donuts. Probably you can guess what the first two are. The last one is maybe not so obvious, and I will tell you about them now. This is work with USI and Tim Linden. So black mergers are when you would have gravity waves from something like neutron star mass mergers, but you would not have your typical beta decaying neutron star fluid. So remember a kilonova, oh, I haven't told you, but a kilonova is the beta decay of all this neutron star fluid flung from a neutron star merger that creates a days-long luminous outburst. People are looking for them right now. So for a black merger, you don't get any kilonova accompanying the collapsed neutron star merger in a galactic interior. So all these imploded pulsars, when they merge, shouldn't give you our process events. That could perhaps be seen statistically, because we'd start seeing a lot of mergers nearby that looked like two solar mass black holes, or rather we'd see a large population of low mass merger events without an accompanying kilonova.
Joe, can you say again what the process is that you're looking at? So these are black,
yeah.
So you have two neutron stars going around each other?
So sorry, I mean, when I say black mergers, it's just what you said before. You converted all these neutron stars at the galactic center to black holes.
Yes.
So now you have these low mass black hole mergers that you thought were going to have neutron stars in them, and they just don't anymore.
So
you have these low mass mergers, no kilonova. That's it. So you just get this
ENM signals.
Yeah, without the ENM signal, precisely, yeah. And so here we have two ADM models. These roughly span that green parameter space that I was showing you before. And so either within something like 3 kiloparsecs of the center of a typical Milky Way galaxy, or even up to within about 9 kiloparsecs of the center of a Milky Way galaxy, you wouldn't see any kilonova going off. So that's actually far enough out that you'd expect to see the kilonova. So if you can see a kilonova, no one knows how bright they are yet.
Aren't you also just supposed to be able to see at the end of the merger just from the gravitational wave signal that it's different between a...
So we looked into that quite deeply, and I hold much less hope for doing that than what I just said. We tried a lot of different things to try to get that to work, but
because
the final merger is not in bands.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's
fourth order in the post-Newtonian approximation to see the sort of tidal forces between the neutron stars. So that's pretty much out. But what we looked at was a spin precession of sort of the maximally spinning case. But it turns out that a collapsed neutron star, at least using typical dimensional analysis, doesn't give you a really highly spinning black hole. So you can't really use that either. So that's that. Okay, so quiet kilonovae are when you would see a kilonovae, because we'll have better telescopes. The Zwicky Transient Factory and Blackjam are coming online, and they'll be searching, and they'll see these kilonovae, but they won't see, we won't see any gravity waves corresponding to them at LIGO. This is roughly the rate distribution per kiloparsec of these events in a typical Milky Way galaxy for those two different models. And so it's peaked at what you can think of as an implosion radius. So most of the neutron stars are imploded behind this radius, and most of the neutron stars are actively imploding at this radius. And if you've thought in your head about the consequences of that, you'll understand what our process donuts are. So what you can do is you can stack up all these quiet kilonova events, and you should see that because they would occur at a certain fixed radius in all these disk galaxies, if you stacked all the galaxies together, you'd get a donut shape of quiet kilonovae. And then you get another donut of kilonovae from merger events that actually have an accompanying gravity wave signal outside of that. So that's a pretty striking signal to look for.
How many events do you need to do such a
thing? I don't know. Okay. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is a dark matter ignition of type 1a supernovae. So dark matter that implodes pulsars also collapses inside and can explode white dwarfs. And this could actually be the origin of type 1a supernovae. Okay. So the standard story of type 1a supernovae is that you have a thermonuclear flame front that's ignited in a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. You have the nuclei fusing up to 56 nickel, then they decay down to 56 cobalt and 56 iron. And this gives you the light curves that were used to discover dark energy. The Phillips relation tells you there's this fixed relationship between the width and height of these curves. But it turns out that recently this very classic paradigm has come into question because sub-Chandrasekhar supernovae have been discovered. So you can tell what the mass of the supernovae is by looking at the shape of the light curve. And more massive White dwarfs will have a broader light curve because there will be more optical trapping, so the light will escape less quickly, and you'll have a broader, slightly more loose light curve. Less massive white dwarfs, the light will escape more quickly, so this purple curve is something like a low mass type 1a, and the red data is something like a high mass type 1a.
This is already after this Phillips rescaling?
No Phillips rescaling here. Oh, I'm sorry. It is Phillips rescaled. It is after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
I didn't follow. Sorry. I mean, like.
Yeah.
The duration you're saying is set by the opacity, but the brightness though is set by the nickel mass.
Yeah.
But those two are different than each other.
Mm-hmm.
So then from that, how do you get the mass of the gender? Sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a fine. I mean, the truth is the Phillips relation isn't quite perfect. Is the lesson here, especially if you have different mass supernovae, which we do. So actually, the Phillips relation isn't perfect. So we should see if we've rescaled them. And the Phillips relation was perfect. They would all lie right on top of each other, but they don't. And so what we're seeing is a variation, and that corresponds to a mass difference in the progenitors. We can talk about it later. Yeah. Sorry. All right, so here's how dark matter would ignite supernovae. So heavy dark matter thermalizes inside a small volume within the white dwarf and collects to the point of self-gravitation within 100 or million to a billion years. And then it collapses, and as it collapses, it's shedding its gravitational potential energy, and it can ignite a type 1a supernova. But we already know from the very beginning of this talk that more massive white dwarfs would have dark matter collapsing sooner in it, and less massive white dwarfs would have dark matter collapsing later in it. And that's simply because the more massive white dwarfs are going to be denser. And so the dark matter is going to thermalize into a much smaller volume inside of them. They'll also capture more dark matter because they're more massive. And so for both those reasons, there's a shorter time for dark matter to ignite heavy type 1a supernovae. There's also an unexplained correlation between the age of type 1a supernovae host galaxies and the stretch of the type 1a light curves. Or in other words, you can look for these small differences in the stretch of these light curves and see that we're finding more stretched light curves from younger galaxies and less stretched light curves from older galaxies.
I have a question. So this Phillips relation is pure empirical relation.
Yes.
Right? It's not derived from.
Noticed by a guy named Phillips. Yes.
Phillips. If it's very empirical, right?
So they
you use it in combination with something.
They use a distance ladder. They use Cepheid variable stars, and they use. And other brightness indicators in nearby galaxies to sort of try to correct for any systematics. But actually, this is a problem for that because it's telling you that you have small systematic errors that actually depend on age. So what you can do is take the data on ages of stars adjacent to type 1a supernova and the data on the mass of type 1a is inferred from luminosity. And you can look at something like a 10 PeV asymmetric dark matter candidate or 100 PeV asymmetric dark matter candidate with cross sections that are at the edge of discovery and are not quite ruled out yet. And you see that you actually get a correlation between age and explosion time that roughly matches the two data points you can make after you bin 32 type 1As on this side and 32 type 1As on this side. So this is actually the same data binning as they used. I just actually showed you the x-axis error bars. OK, so any questions so far? OK, now I'll talk about theoretical motivation for these models very briefly. OK, so something I'd just like to point out, which is interesting, is that these are all the cosmologically stable particles we know in the standard model, plus bosons. Actually, they're stable up to the graviton. But it's been known for a while that, and it's been used in various papers, that these are tuned towards atomic stability and production in supernovae. So those are two different things. So you can show that if you shift the mass or couplings of some of these guys, you'll no longer have stable atoms. And you can show that if you shift the couplings or masses of basically any of these, you won't get supernovae in the abundance or at all that we see.
Sorry,
yeah.
Does that mean a supernova won't happen?
So you can consider increasing the neutrino masses, right? You wouldn't have the same blowback in a core collapse supernova. You wouldn't get a core collapse supernova. You could consider.
No, But even today, I mean, Ricey simulations of supernovae have trouble exploding them.
Yeah, so it's at the edge of what neutrinos can actually do. Actually, I think the recent three-dimensional ones, they say have gotten it, but.
No, I mean.
Okay, well, I'll leave that to you then. But my point is that these processes that make heavy atoms and keep them stable are sensitive to the parameters controlling the masses and couplings of these. That's basically my point. So this is actually used, something called the atomic principle by Donahue et al. In 1996. So if you make your Higgs valve a bit heavier than it is and you leave everything else set, you don't get any atoms because the mass of the difference between the mass of the neutron and the proton increases to above an MeV, and you no longer have stable nuclei. So a very basic point I'd just like to make is if you just varied this atomic principle a little bit and said, I want all cosmologically stable matter to be tuned for heavy element production, this would be the sort of dark sector you would look for. Robert's busily searching for exceptions. That's good. Really quick, I'll talk about technical naturalness. So actually, I think, I didn't expect this, but a lot of people here know what this is, so I'll just say it really quickly. So technical naturalness says that all terms in your Lagrangian that preserve symmetries of your theory should have order one coefficients. One exception to this, or one thing that may be an exception to this, is the Higgs mass. So it turns out that if I look at what the Higgs mass should be, given quantum corrections from scum scale lambda, it's quadratically sensitive to lambda. And this is something that bothers a lot of people. Something that's always puzzled me is it seems like maybe technical naturalness assumes scanning from the outset, or something like aesthetics. Because if I'm talking about the terms of my Lagrangian having order one coefficients, it seems like either something's setting those coefficients, or I just want them to have order one coefficients because of aesthetics. So two more slides. So you might say that something like a technically natural universe is appealing aesthetically, because you have something like double well potential or tilted potentials breaking your symmetries. This is either through gauge mediation or some spontaneous breaking. And your other universe is really confusing, because here you're sitting at some point in this multidimensional moduli space. The potential I used for this was some sort of plate, and I made it flat because this is perhaps a shallower approach. It's not clear what the hell I mean here, which is kind of the point. It's messy, and we don't really know what to do with it. Just as a little bit of stimulation, because I learned some things about aesthetics in a former life, I'll introduce you to a different kind of aesthetics. It's a Japanese form of pottery called kintsugi. What it is if you smash a vase or some sort of urn or something, you can actually solder it back together with gold. And the idea is it's supposed to be more beautiful afterwards. And so if you think about this multidimensional moduli space, maybe what I'm saying is that maybe there's some part of it that we can see where if I vary the parameters, I'm no longer producing heavy elements. Maybe there's some part of it that we haven't found yet. Basically, the idea is these two things could fit together such that if you varied your parameters very much, you would no longer produce heavy elements in both pieces. And it's interesting maybe to think which piece is the dark sector, which piece is the visible sector. OK, so enough of that. And I should say I like the last part of my talk better, even though I really did want to say that. So the next thing I'll talk about is a new way to search for dark matter. This is dark kinetic heating of neutron stars. This is a great recent project I did with Masha Baryakhtar, Shirley Lee, Tim Linden, and Nirmal Raj. OK, before I tell you a new way to search for dark matter, I have to tell you the old ways that people have searched for dark matter. When you're searching for dark matter, there are some clear targets. One of them is a thermal relic abundance WIMP. I won't get into the production of WIMPs today, but I will tell you that a typical WIMP cross-section is 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. And it looks like, based on present constraints, that cross-section is under a lot of pressure. So Lux and Panda XSI, which are xenon, CDMS, which is germanium and silicon, and CREST, which is, it's oxygen for that curve. Have all bounded this parameter space quite well. But this is for spin-independent coupling of dark matter to nucleons, which gives you a coherent enhancement to the constraint that goes like 1 over a squared. But if you consider something like a spin-dependent model, where the WIMP is actually coupling to the spin of the nucleus, then actually get a much worse constraint because you no longer have that coherent enhancement. So it's been a problem for a while now how you actually probe spin-dependent WIMPs efficiently. These neutrino floors are set by actually taking every point in mass space and asking what's the recoil energy spectrum in that space if I only find, what's the recoil energy spectrum in that space? And then how far of a bound can I set before I should see one neutrino event in that recoil energy bin? And then you plot this. This tells you that once you've started probing cross sections at that level, you'd start running into this background from solar and atmospheric neutrinos. Next, I'll explain elastic dark matter really quickly. Elastic dark matter scatters kind of like you think it would. So dark matter comes in, it hits a nucleus. The nucleus gets a bunch of recoil energy, and dark matter goes back out. You can contrast this with inelastic dark matter, where dark matter scatters with a nucleus, but then it turns into a heavier state, and it jets off again, a nucleus with recoil energy. But the point is, if this is the only way dark matter can scatter, and by the way, this is different than inelastic scattering of like electrons off neutrons or something like that, because this would be the only way dark matter could scatter based on some symmetry. So if this is the only way dark matter can scatter based on some symmetry, then you need your recoil energy, which is the mass of your nucleus times roughly the velocity of the dark matter in the halo squared, to be greater than the mass splitting between x1 and x2, or else this is entirely forbidden. So this is another type of dark matter that it's very hard for dark matter experiments to find, especially if they don't look for it. So I did a project that showed that while right now the experiments only really analyze their data up to about 30 kV, which would leave them sensitive to mass splittings of about 180 kV at xenon experiments, really they should be analyzing up to something like 500 kV so they could get up to 400 or 500 kV mass splittings. So one candidate for inelastic dark matter that's very well motivated is the Higgs-Zeno. And the reason there's a mass splitting between the two Higgs-Zeno states is that the Higgs-Zeno starts out as two Majorana fermions in the minimal supersymmetric standard model. And if those two Majorana fermions are completely mass degenerate, then you're allowed to exchange a single Z boson with a nucleon, and you actually get that WIMP cross-section of 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. But in the MSSM, there are other states around called the Beano and the Weino, and so you have to diagonalize your mass matrix to find your mass eigenbasis, just like you do with neutrinos. And when you do that, where these off-diagonal terms come up from electroweak symmetry breaking, this results in up to GV mass splittings between your Higgs-Zenos for something like TV mass M1 and M2, which are the Beano and Weino mass parameters. And if the dark matter is too inelastic, so you can't do that inelastic process at a direct detection machine, then you have to go through loop processes. And actually, we have researchers here who are still researching actively right now what the exact cross-section would be for a Higgs-Zeno scattering off of a nucleon in the case that it has to go through this loop process as opposed to the inelastic process. But it's very, very small and perhaps below the neutrino floor. OK, so one of the reasons my collaborators and I looked into this is because we were really excited about four neutrino events at CREST that looked like they could be a Higgs-Zeno, and which weren't explained by any background in the CREST paper. So we found a Higgs-Zeno at very low significance and four high recoil energy events at CREST. But then being good phenomenologists, we checked all the other experiments. And it turns out that because PICO, which is a bubble chamber and has to accept every recoil energy and not just up to some threshold in an analysis, they accept up to 1 MeV recoil energies. They exclude the CREST Higgs-Zeno. So this is PICO. It excludes up to 200 kV. That's sort of where this CREST Higgs-Zeno would have sat if it had been real data, but it wasn't.
Previous incarnations of CREST had the backgrounds that were stretching far into the high energy end.
Sure, yeah.
And the corrected CREST the same failing, and then it's not surprising.
I agree this is tilting at windmills, though, but this was a small subsection at the end of our paper, just as something, a curiosity, but yes, yeah, okay. So The point we made is if you go to higher recoil searches, you can do much better at searching for this sort of inelastic dark matter, but it really only gets you up to about 500 keV, and really you want to get up to about a GeV for Higgs Xenos. And so you could ask, in general, what's an ideal direct detector, given all these limitations of direct detectors that I just went over? So you would want something that can probe mass scales evenly and be less weak-centric. So we're weak-centric simply because the masses of our nuclei are roughly around 100 GeV, which is just a weird coincidence, but that means you're going to get the best bounds around 100 GeV. So it'd be good if we could get around that. You'd want something that's sensitive without nuclear coherence. So something like spin-dependent dark matter could be probed just as well as spin-independent dark matter. And it'd be nice if I could just magically accelerate dark matter to the speed of light so I could blast inelastic dark matter with really hard recoils against against targets. And so to focus our attention a little bit, I'm going to talk about dark matter heated astronaut. So let's say I have an astronaut floating out in space, and I want to consider that astronaut heated by dark matter. I could ask, how many hits per year does that astronaut experience? And it turns out that right now direct detection experiments are sensitive to something like 100 kilogram years. So if I assume a 100 kilogram astronaut, then the astronaut can be hit about once per year at the limit of current direct detection.
You can go to much higher cross sections so that you don't have better detection limits.
Sure. I'm just talking about like what's going on in the typical WIMP parameter space. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But one hit per year is possible. Yes. Okay. So you could ask, what's the dark kinetic heating of this astronaut? So the dark kinetic heating of this astronaut is roughly one event per year times the recoil energy of the dark matter on carbon, which for a heavy WIMP would go something like mass of carbon times its velocity in the halo squared. And if I set that equal to a black body spectrum, 4 pi radius of the astronaut squared times the Stefan-Boltzmann constant times the temperature of the fourth, I find that the astronaut's heated up to 75 microkelvin, which isn't very much, but it's a little bit. But actually, I didn't do that calculation correctly, or perfectly, because the velocity of the dark matter isn't just its halo velocity. It actually gets a little bump from the gravitational potential well of the astronaut. And that bump is incredibly tiny in this case. It's something like a bump of 81 microns per second. So it's not helping me very much in this case. However, if my astronaut were instead a neutron star, it would help me. Because you could think of neutron stars as nature's dark matter accelerators, because they literally are nature's dark matter accelerators. So a dark matter particle coming into the neutron star gets accelerated up to 0.7 times the speed of light. So if you think about the neutron star as a detector, its interior is a fiducial mass of 10 to the 57 GeV, and it's about 10 part neutrons to 1 part proton to 1 part electrons. And so dark kinetic heating proceeds as follows. You have dark matter gravitational accelerated to 0.7 times the speed of light by the neutron star. It scatters with the neutron star. If it's heavier than about a GeV, it'll have to rescatter to deposit all its kinetic energy, but otherwise it deposits it immediately. And it scatters against neutrons, electrons, or protons. This heats the neutron star, resulting in black body emission. And so you could ask, how hot should I expect old neutron stars to be? And the answer is that after about 100 million years, given any standard literature cooling calculation, you should expect your neutron stars to be black bodies with effective temperatures of less than 1,000 Kelvin, with some dependence on the crust over the first 10 million years, but really that drops out after 10 million years. So we don't have to even worry about what the crust composition of the neutron star is. So most neutron stars are older than about a billion years, by which time you'd have an effective temperature of about 100 Kelvin. And the maximum dark kinetic heating you can expect is about 1750 Kelvin. So I'm going to show you a plot of pulsars on a pulse period versus spin down period plot. And the only point here is that we want all these old unspun pulsars for this analysis. Or rather, there is a population of pulsars that roughly would work to do this sort of analysis. And that lies here. And so it's a sizable portion of the pulsars we've seen. However, we haven't seen a pulsar close enough yet. So the closest we've seen a pulsar so far is about 80 parsecs to 100 parsecs away from Earth. And so the first strategy, I would say, to actually find dark kinetic heating or rule it out would be what I call the backyard neutron star barbecue. So these neutron stars at 1700 Kelvin are roughly at the temperature of an industrial barbecue. And so the first thing you could try to do is to find a few pulsars with the new radio telescopes that are coming online that will have order of magnitude better sensitivities, like FAST and SCA. CHIME perhaps will be able to search for pulsars. That would be wonderful. And using new pulsars that we find, we could actually look for this at up to about 50 parsecs from Earth. Using the James Webb Space Telescope or the 30-meter telescope. So the two sigma integration times to look for dark kinetic heating are something like 10 to the 5 seconds, and it scales as distance to the fourth at 10 parsecs for the James Webb Space Telescope. You do considerably better with the 30-meter telescope. Not considerably. You do somewhat better with the 30-meter telescope. Actually, when you get to the European Extremely Large Telescope, you actually do start doing a lot better. But in something like 7 times 10 to the 4 seconds, you can image or rule out neutron star.
Distance to the 4?
It's in a background-dominated regime. So the background light in this case is, for the 30-meter telescope, something called zodiacal light.
So it's like doing a... doing stochastic search of sorts. That's
right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this is done. I mean, this is how they have to do most of the searches in the IR.
No, I'm pretty sure it's done. I just want to understand the scaling.
Yeah. If the dark matter is annihilating, actually you start doing much, much better. And the reason is that you're shifting the black body spectrum more to optical frequencies, and you don't have as much of a background at the 30-meter telescope. The James Webb telescope is just a matter of actually jacking up its luminosity. That's why you're doing better there. But you could consider a long-term braze. So if you found a 100-meter telescope or an OWL, you would get a 2-sigma sensitivity on known pulsars in about 100 hours. So that'd be an excellent task for exoplanet atmosphere telescopes. But I should say, in both these cases, I'm in conversations with astronomers, and maybe we can do better. I'm not quite sure yet. OK, so really quick, I'll explain what the sensitivity curves are going to look like. So for dark matter, to lose its halo kinetic energy, which is about 10 to the minus 6 times its mass, by scattering at the neutrons, well, dark matter has to lose that energy in order to get captured by the neutron star, is the point. So you can compare that energy to the energy lost in a single scattering event, which is about GeV for dark matter coming in at the speed of light and a nucleon mass. And that tells you immediately that the mass at which one scatter is no longer going to suffice to capture the dark matter is around a PeV. And the saturation cross-section, or the cross-section for which you capture all the dark matter, is just the physical cross-section of the neutron star divided by the number of nucleons in the neutron star, which is just the mass of a nucleon divided by the mass of the star, which gives you 2 times 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared. So this is sort of the minimum cross-section to capture all the dark matter. You can consider a dark matter that's lighter than a GeV, and something different happens, because you can't scatter with all the fermions because you're polyblocked. So only a fraction, delta P over PF, where delta P is the momentum transfer in the scattering event of the neutrons, can scatter above the Fermi surface. And this tells you that for masses less than a GeV, scattering will be suppressed by a factor of mass of the dark matter divided by the Fermi momentum, which is about 200 MeV. So when you plug all that in, you start with a sensitivity curve that starts at a GeV at 2 times 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared and scales down as 1 over mx from there. For dark matter masses greater than a PeV, you need to scatter a bunch of times in order for the dark matter to become captured. And so here, you can set the kinetic energy equal to the number of times you scatter times the recoil energy. And that's just 1/2 mx times vx squared. And the number of scatters scales roughly as the number of nucleons in the star times the cross-section per nucleon times the radius of the star. But then this immediately tells you there's a linear relationship between the cross-section for scattering and the mass of the dark matter when you're in the multi-scatter limit. And so because I already know the normalization at PeV is roughly 2 times 10 to the minus 45, that's actually all the information I need. And I immediately know that the saturation cross-section for dark matter heavier than a PeV just scales up with the dark matter mass. And so what you find is a fairly impressive sensitivity curves. So it turns out that if you ruled out a neutron star at 1750 Kelvin, you'd already be ruling out a very large portion of this low mass dark matter parameter space that people are very interested in. For these sorts of telescopes I've been talking about, 30 meter telescope, the extremely large telescope, and James Webb telescope, the most you could get down to is about 1,000 Kelvin. But this is actually already well below the neutrino floor at high masses and also below the neutrino floor at low masses, so that's quite interesting. The ultimate limit actually lies well below either the spin-dependent or the spin-independent neutron floor.
Joe,
neutrino floor. Excuse
so
me.
Why there is no heating just by usual stuff? There's quite a bit of
heat. Yeah, so I didn't go over all the systematics because this is a colloquium. But so around us, there is an average density of 0.001 atoms per centimeter cubed. So if I compare that, and those are mostly helium, or no, excuse me, those are mostly hydrogen. So that's telling you that the density of baryons around to actually accrete onto the neutron star is much lower than the density of dark matter. So at least to start out with, you wouldn't expect that to be a background. Actually, you wouldn't expect that to be a background anyway, because most models of baryonic accretion onto neutron stars show a lot of the baryons being deflected. And more than that, while I just quoted the average baryon density around us, that's actually mostly clumped. And so you should have neutron stars that actually aren't hitting those clumps.
What,
right, because also you may expect this neutron star to drift around.
You'd want a lone neutron star,
right.
But that's not a crazy requirement. So neutron stars were born sort of at a rate that peaked about 10 billion years ago, as Udai and I have been playing around with lately. And we're just kind of jettisoned out at 100 kilometers per second velocities. And so actually, all these neutron stars around us, most of them are actually in periodic orbits in and out of the disk. And they are kind of sitting there by themselves. So it should be OK. OK, so conclusions. Some astrophysical hints that dark matter could implode pulsars and ignite type 1a supernovae. I talked about some new interesting signatures to look for, including quiet kilonovae and our process donuts. I talked about dark kinetic heating of neutron stars as a powerful new method for detecting dark matter. So thank you very much.
So we have a few questions already, quite a few. So any follow-up questions to Joe?
Yeah.
How long? So going back to your Slurpee neutron star thing.
It depends on the initial mass of the black hole, how long it takes before it accretes it.
How long?
I'd want to pull up an actual equation. I might have it in one of my bonus slides. I'll check. It can get down to a year sort of time scales at this high for these high mass asymmetric dark matter models. So about a year if I just assume Bondi accretion.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if dark matter does heat up the neutron star, how would you know?
What do we do after? Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So I mean, there are a lot of things to do. First of all, you can get the velocities of all these neutron stars, and so you can use their relative velocity to the dark matter halo to start seeing if that gives you the correct scaling of 1/1 relative velocity for the capture rate, or in this case, the kinetic heating. That sounds hard to do, and it is.
Yeah.
But the other thing you can do is you can try to get their masses either through direct imaging of their size or
the masses of the neutron star.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you can at least confirm that this is consistent across the population with heating, which changes quite dramatically as a function of mass. I can show you plots on that, definitely.
Yeah. So does it depend on the equation of state of
So I mean, here in this green region, we have various neutron star equations of state that seem to fit all the observed neutron stars that we've seen. Actually use the temperature of observed neutron stars and their radii to constrain this. And the basic point is there are a few ways to do this. So first, if you just collect a bunch of pulsars, you can verify that this is at least consistent with either an annihilation heating or kinetic heating scenario, because you should see a spread in luminosities if you have a spread in masses of 1 to 2 solar masses of something like a factor of 6 to 10 for kinetic heating and 1 to 2 for annihilation heating. So that's at least one check you can do immediately. You can also try to verify individual masses and then see if you're getting the heating you expected from that, either for the kinetic or annihilation case. To try to limit the scenario that it's from accreted baryons, you can actually image the area around using something like hydrogen lines or something like that. But yeah, it would be something you would have to work on.
Right. If there are no more questions, let's thank Joe again.
Thank you.